1-1 pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeouts for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
Strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager, that just happened. Thank you very much.
Now, here's your host, Gary Hill.
And welcome back to the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast. Gary Hill back with you. A full podcast we have in store today. Thanks for coming back. Mariners fall to the Yankees, swept aside by New York. So we'll talk about the day game yesterday. Taijuan Walker pitched in that one. It pitched well. And we'll talk about that briefly because today, yesterday, a big news day as a trade went down. We'll talk all about that coming up. You'll hear from Jack Zarenczyk coming up in just a couple of moments on the big trade as the Mariners add a bat to the lineup. Also coming up, we're going to talk to Jeff Zimmerman. We're going to dive a little in-depth on WAR, its place in terms of defense and how it fits into WAR, and how it all affects Edgar Martinez. So we'll talk about that coming up in a few minutes as well. Roenis Elias pitches tonight. He'll take the ball for the Mariners as the M's will start a new series, this time with the Tampa Bay Rays, a four-game weekend set. And before the last time Elias pitched, I put together a little feature on his changeup. So I'll play that for you, and we'll talk a little bit about the Elias change. And we'll talk about the preview and who he faces tonight, an old friend. That comes up as well. So a lot to get to. Let's talk trade first, though, as the M's make an acquisition.
Swing and a well-hit ball deep to left field. Liddy going back to the warning track, looking up. Goodbye, baseball. In and out of the upper deck toward left center field. Holy smokes, what a shot by Mark Trumbo. In and out of the upper tank here at Safeco Field, and the Angels now lead it 3-1 on Trumbo's seventh blast, and I mean blast, of the year. Swing and a well-hit ball deep to left field. Going back as Wells looking up, and this one is way out of here. Goodbye, baseball, off the 7:10 a.m. ESPN sign on the facade of the upper deck. Mark Trumbo, with his 24th home run of the season deep into the night, has just tied this game.
And that's the biggest name in the deal. Mark Trumbo coming over from the Arizona Diamondbacks, and he is known for his tremendous power. 29 home runs in 2011, 32 in his All-Star season in 2012, and bashed 34 homers in his last season in an Angels uniform, driving in 100 in 2013. Suffered through an injury-plagued year last year, swatting 14. He has 9 this year so far and 23 RBIs. We'll talk more about Trumbo and his skill set in just a few minutes, but let's hear all about the trade from both sides. Here's Jack Zarenczyk, Mariners general manager.
Our thoughts were simple, that I think you look at where we're at offensively, and we're not doing exactly what I thought we would do or what most people thought we would do, and Trumbo's a guy that I think brings an awful lot to the table. You know, big power hitter that will bat somewhere in the middle of our lineup. I thought it would be really good insurance for the ball club. and in terms of Vidal Nuno, you know, it's no secret what's happened to our pitching here just recently from a physical standpoint. And to bring a pitcher like him who has started in the past, he's also been in the bullpen. He's a versatile kid. He's tough. He's got 5 years of control. You know, we think it's an asset to the organization. So these players hopefully will be here tomorrow and open for questions.
Jack, where do you envision Trumbo playing mostly?
I mean, he's played right field primarily for the Diamondbacks. He's been a first baseman. He's played left field. Of course, we have the DH spot. But I think more than anything else, we'll have some type of rotating system where, you know, he'll get his ABs, and along with Nelson, along with the other corner players. So I think that'll still unfold. But you know, more than anything else, to bring the bat to this organization is really what we were desiring to do.
Was right-handed bat a priority, or was it just any bat that you wanted to adapt to this lineup?
You know, we've always liked Trumbo. I mean, I could go back several years ago where we always thought that, you know, this guy would be a very desirable player to get. So it wasn't necessarily the right-handed bat. That helps, and it's good to have it. But it was just to bring someone that has this type of skill set, the power, the experience, a veteran player, knows the division, knows the American League. I think it all worked out well.
Where does the pitcher fit for you?
At this moment, yes. He'll go into our bullpen. So as Dominic Leone leaves, he'll come in. And that now gives us three left-handers in our bullpen. So I don't know if you saw the game the other night. You may or may not know a lot about him. He's a San Diego kid, and as I said, he started in relief the other night in a 17-inning ball game where Milwaukee went into 17 innings with Arizona. He pitched 5 innings of relief. I think he was right at 90 pitches. He had 5 shutout innings, and in the 6th inning he gave up a home run. But, you know, I thought it was – we happened to watch the game. You know, I thought it was tall telling that this kid's got a lot of guts. He throws strikes. He's not afraid. And I said to add a third left-hander to your bullpen, I think, is a good arsenal to have.
Jack, are you bringing up Sue Gray as your other catcher?
That's a good guess. You know, they have a game tonight in Tacoma, so we shall see as that unfolds.
Guerrero, obviously, a kid with a big future. Tough to give up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, even Reinheimer, you know, both kids, you know, you hate to give up young kids. You know, you never like to do it. You know, but at the same sense, I think if you could look at the skill set that a Trumbo has and figure this guy might add 25 to 30 home runs to your ball club, you know, and do it now, you know, with a club that can use that at this point, you know, yeah, we hate to give up both players because one's a nice little shortstop, you know, and the other one is a guy that has upside. But they were, at least one of them we thought was a few years away, several years away. And, you know, it's our job to replenish the system. So, you know, we're out there. We have the draft come around the corner, and we have players in our system. And, you know, so between Tim Kistner and Tom McNamara, you know, let's replace them.
So as you know, we'll see him at a little at first base, a little at DH, a little in left field as well. I imagine we'll see some sort of rotation between Cruz, Seth Smith, and also Mark Trumbo kind of rotating through the DH, right field, left field. Even Logan Morrison involved with first base as well. So some sort of, I guess, timeshare is the way to look at it. Trumbo has always been looked at as kind of a natural DH, not a bad first baseman as well. Mariners will give up some defensively with him in the outfield. But a guy that doesn't walk a ton, his on-base percentage, .299 right now. He'll strike out two, fanned 184 times in 2013, but he will hit the ball out of the ballpark, and it doesn't matter what park he's in. He's got tremendous power. He's hit his share at Safeco Field. He certainly knows Safeco Field. He knows the division, of course, spending 2010 through 2013 in an Angels uniform. Mariners know him awfully well. A guy, he'll wrap around some doubles as well, has gone over 30 doubles a couple times in his career. And no doubt we'll be hitting somewhere in the middle of the order. And as Jack Cerenzik mentioned, looking to lengthen the lineup. And it's going to be interesting to see how the lineup looks with him in the middle of it. You know, whether he bats behind Seager or how it's going to work. But a big bat added to the Mariners lineup. Vidal Nuño added as well. I think this is an interesting acquisition. A guy the Mariners will have control over for the next number of years. Not a hard thrower, sits about 89 miles per hour. An array of pitches that he'll go to. Mixes in a fastball, a couple of different fastballs, really. Got a slider he'll go to about 40% of the time. He's been throwing it a lot. Mixes in his curve. He's got a changeup as well. He'll try and keep hitters off balance. You can look at him as kind of a swing guy, a guy that can pitch out of the pen. He can give you some starts as well. In his major league time, he's mostly spent his time in the rotation. He's come out of the bullpen for Arizona so far this year. He's just pitched in 3 games, but a 1.88 ERA. He was pitched in that crazy game just a couple of days ago, the same day that the Mariners went in extra innings, a wild one between Arizona and Milwaukee, a game that went 17 innings. Nuño, unfortunately, for Arizona, he ended up taking the loss in the ball game, but it's kind of hard to fault him for that one. He ended up going just over 5 innings, so 5 1/3 innings. He took the loss when he gave up a home run, but he pitched 5 clean before that, gave up 2 hits, 1 run, walked 3, and fanned 6, and threw 92 pitches in the ballgame. So he's stretched out. He can come to the M's and pretty much fill any sort of role they would want him to fill at this point. He had an outing of 6 2/3 earlier this year, earlier in May as well. Then against the Cardinals, 2 1/3 innings. All of his work out of the bullpen so far this year. Previous to that was a starter for Arizona. Last season, a 3.76 ERA in 14 games, 83 innings, fanned 69 in that time. Then pitched for the Yankees in 2014 and 2013. He came over in the Brandon McCarthy deal from New York to Arizona. Originally drafted by the Cleveland Indians, was let go by the Indians, picked up by the Yankees, and he just really sawed through their minor league system. He was outstanding, got to the big leagues, and now he's been dealt a couple of times, and now he'll be a Seattle Mariner and presumably part of the bullpen as he comes over. So again, we'll have much more on both of those guys as we move through the next few days, but they should be in town tomorrow. We'll see if Mark Trumbo will be in the lineup as Seattle takes on the Tampa Bay Rays in Game 1 of a series coming up. Now, the last game of the Yankees series didn't go that well for the M's yesterday. It did go well in this sense. Taijuan Walker was outstanding once again. He followed up what was a tremendous start against Cleveland, where he went 8 innings and gave up just a couple of runs. And it was a solid follow-up as he goes 8 innings again, gives up 5 hits, 3 runs, 1 walk, and 7 strikeouts. Gave up a couple of long balls, but I think that's a start that you'll take every single time. All on 108 pitches. Charlie Furbush finished the deal without giving up a run. But for the M's, just not able to get enough going offensively. Yankees strike first. They score 1 in the second, but the Mariners able to tie the game in the third inning.
The pause, and here's Tanaka's 3-1 pitch. Swinging, it's lifted well down to left center field. Flores moving over, back to the warning track. He can't get there. It bounces off the track, and now high off the wall. Extra bases for Ackley. Miller scores easily from third base, and Dustin Ackley hits a slicer into left field, and we are tied at 1 as Ackley stands up with a double.
So the Mariners now have it tied up at 1-1 at that point, but really it was just few and far between in terms of opportunities for the M's after that.
Here comes the Tanaka 1-2, strike 3 called. Seager to it right away. 96 miles an hour from Tanaka's right arm. That's the top velocity we've seen today. Tanaka making his first big league start since April 23rd, and he has carved up the Mariners like it was a holiday here. Through 7 innings, he has struck out 9 over 7 frames and allowed only 1 run.
And he just fits right in with some of the dominant pitchers that the M's have seen. Some question marks, though, how Tanaka would come out. He hadn't been on the mound in a while, but he looks sharp. 7 innings, 3 hits, 1 run, no walks, and 9 punchouts. And he did it all on 78 pitches. And the problem with facing the New York Yankees, especially late in the ball game, you can't play from behind late. Betances down to today. He'd pitched so much recently, but Betances, you know, his last 5 ball games, he had recorded 16 outs, 14 of them on strikeouts in his last 5 games. He has been dominant and invincible this year in a setup role. And Andrew Miller has been basically the same. Mariners scored 1 run off of him yesterday, and they threatened today. He came into this series only yielding 2 earned runs on the season. Betances and Miller had combined for over 50 innings pitched and 2 earned runs allowed. Right now, the best 1-2 punch, 1-2 bullpen punch going in baseball right now. Those two guys are outstanding. And Miller, a 5-out save to close it down.
Here's the stretch and the 3-2 pitch, swinging a ground ball to third. Up of the ball is Edley, the toss across, and it's in time. Ball game is over. The Yankees win it 3-1, and the Yankees complete a 3-game sweep over the Mariners here at Safeco Field.
So before we move on to the Tampa Bay Rays, I think it's worth for at least a moment here looking at Andrew Miller, because I think his career path is pretty interesting and just another lesson in, I guess, patience more than anything. Miller was a guy who was a very high draft pick out of North Carolina. You go back to his draft in 2006 in the first round. He was the 6th pick overall and very highly thought of out of North Carolina. You look at that draft, and Miller was drafted, you know, just behind Brandon Morrow. Get this. So Miller was taken sixth by the Tigers, one spot ahead of Clayton Kershaw, taken by the Dodgers, just a handful of spots ahead of Tim Lincecum, who was taken by the Giants, and 11th overall, the Diamondbacks took Max Scherzer. So that tells you, I think, exactly what people thought of Andrew Miller coming out of North Carolina. But he had a hard time clicking for Detroit. Came up young, 21 years old, 6'10 ERA, pitching out of the bullpen in a handful of innings. 2007, the next year, came up, pitched 13 games in the rotation, a 5'6'3 ERA. And then he gets traded to Florida, was part of that mammoth deal between the Marlins and Tigers, the one that sent Miguel Cabrera and Dontrell Willis to the Tigers, all kinds of players going back to the Marlins, including Andrew Miller. He's one of the centerpieces of the deal. But again, just never found it pitching out of the rotation in the pen in 08, a 5.87 ERA, in 09, a 4.84, mainly pitching out of the bullpen at that point. And then his last year with the Marlins in 2010, an 8.54 ERA, a handful of those games spent in the rotation. And then at that point, the Marlins trade him to the Red Sox. So new life with the Red Sox, and still in 2011, wasn't able to turn the corner, a 5.54 ERA. And then you go to 2012 as a 27-year-old, a 3.35 ERA in 53 games out of the bullpen. In 40 innings, he fanned 51 hitters. And that was really the turnaround, because in 2013, had another nice season for Boston out of the bullpen and was dominant last year between Boston and Baltimore, helping the O's into the postseason as a 29-year-old. And he's taken it to a whole nother level this year as a 30-year-old in New York. It's taken a long time to get there, but this is sometimes the career path for guys. And it was interesting to hear him talk about it with Aaron Goldsmith.
Andrew, your career has been a really interesting one. A high first-round draft pick, a starter, then a reliever, and now a closer as you're in your 10th season. Entering this year, you had one save in 9 years, and this year you have been nearly untouchable, already 15 saves. What has it been like for you as a first year as the New York Yankees closer?
It's been a great start. I think, we all want to get, this season off to a good start, or, join a new team and show what you can do. But it's a good team. It's been a good group. We've played pretty well in general. We've had a couple stretches where we'd like to play better, but in general, we've been a pretty good team, and I think it's a long ways to go, but, we got nine pretty good guys that are on the field at most times, and we like our chances.
Some pitchers will say that there's no difference between pitching in the eighth inning, for example, and the ninth inning. Others will say there's an absolute difference between pitching in the ninth and in the eighth. What has been your take on it so far?
I'm trying to treat it the same. I think I'm trying to treat the ninth inning or, the save situation just as I would, any other situation. But in reality, it's definitely different. I think it carries a little bit of extra weight. And, I think it's a little bit disingenuous if you think it's the same as everything else. But at the same time, when you go out there, it's pitch to pitch and batter to batter. And I think if you execute that way, everything will be all right.
Your repertoire seems to be a simple one and yet a very advanced one in other ways. A mid-90s fastball and a slider that this year has been just nearly untouchable. What has been the progression over the course of your career of the slider developing into just an absolute wipeout pitch?
I think the key word you said is progression. I think I've just tried to get better every time out. And I know I went through some phases where the game wasn't going the way I wanted it to, but I feel like I've just continually gotten better the last few years, and slider's been a big part of that. I feel like it's a pitch that's always been pretty good for me, but I've started to locate it and use it different ways and change it more and more throughout the count. I think that's just something that comes with experience, but it's something I feel like I'm improving every time out.
You have a long frame. You're 6'7". A lot of fans here remember Randy Johnson, a little bit taller, and how early in his career, Randy really struggled to throw strikes and then was able to kind of control those long levers and turn them into a major asset. It seems like that has happened for you as well. When did that happen exactly?
It's just been a process. I wish it was one thing. I wish it was like a light switch I could just turn on and I could tell you what I did to figure it out. But it's just been a lot of work, and I've had a lot of good people around me, some great coaches. And I think for me, simplifying my mechanics and making everything, as, straightforward as it can possibly be has been a big help for me. But, these guys know the strike zone so well now, they don't really chase a whole lot. So you've got to be able to find a way to get it over, else you're not going to stand much of a chance.
And that's Andrew Miller. I think it's pretty interesting to keep in mind not only that, you know, some guys figure it out eventually, but also it's the toughest part, I think, of evaluating guys when you see a guy with so much talent like Andrew Miller. And it's why you put so much time into a player like Andrew Miller. It's why you have patience with a player like Andrew Miller. And there's guys throughout baseball like this, because you think at some point and you try as best you can to help him do it. You try and help him turn the corner because you see the talent, you see the flashes. You're just kind of waiting and hoping and trying for him to turn the corner. And Andrew Miller eventually did. Not every guy does, but I think it's an interesting case to look at. I also wanted to get to Lloyd McClendon after the game yesterday as the Mariners fell to the Yankees and Andrew Miller. Here's what the skipper said after the ball game.
You know, we're in a funk offensively, and I'm certain we're going to come out of it. You know, it sounds like a broken record, but it's tough. You know, Tanaka had his A game. You know, he elevated when he wanted to elevate. The split was down. It was hard to pick up. He did a nice job against us.
That eighth inning has got to be excruciating when you watch. I mean, the opportunity's there. And
Sure. It's tough. We had a real good pitcher on the ropes, and we couldn't get a big hit.
And so that leads us to tonight. The Mariners will take on Tampa Bay for the first of four. We'll preview the rest of the series coming up in podcast tomorrow, but let's talk about what goes down tonight. Roenis Elias on the hill. We'll get to his change in just a few minutes. He'll take on Erasmo Ramirez, former Mariner, 3-2 with a 5.53 ERA so far on the season. And it's been a very interesting season for the former Mariner, one that in ways I think looks familiar to Mariners fans. Last time out against Baltimore was sensational. Seven innings of scoreless ball against Baltimore, three hits, seven Ks, one walk, no runs. The start before that against Oakland went six, gave up five earned runs, including a couple of homers, and walked five. So the tale of Erasmo in the last two ball games. His numbers really marred thanks to his first couple of outings of the season where he gave up 15 runs combined in five and a third innings. His ERA at one point sitting at 31.50. It steadily declined to 5.53, but still, after a start like that, it takes a long time to wipe away some of those numbers. Mariners have faced a lot of good arms as of late. They'll face more in this Tampa Bay series. We'll see if the Mariners can get the sticks going tonight against Ramirez and Tampa Bay. 7:10 first pitch from Safeco Field. Hope you're there. Hope you join us. Should be a great weather weekend as well at Safeco Field. So before we get to Elias and his changeup, there's a conversation I want to get to right now. It's with Jeff Zimmerman. I really liked what he did. Jeff Zimmerman, you can find him on Twitter, at Jeff W. Zimmerman. Really good stats guy. He writes at Fangraphs. He has his own website, Baseball Heat Maps, which is a good one. Also writes at HardballTimes.com, and that's where I found a couple of his pieces about war. And we talk about war on the podcast once in a while. I feel like war is becoming more and more mainstream by the day. Wins above replacement. And really, what it's meant to do is, at least what it attempts to do, is to measure a player's value. And with everything involved, whether it's offensively, defensively, fielding, base running, the whole thing. And it breaks it down in terms of positional adjustments as well. Guys can have more value if they play middle infield. You know, that sort of thing. So that's what war is supposed to do. Now, I use war. I like war a lot. The thing about war, though, I don't think is the end-all stat. In fact, I don't think there is an end-all stat. I think to tell the story about a player's performance, I think what you need is to put together a lot of different numbers. Try and put the whole picture together in a lot of different ways. I think that's the way to go about it at this point. I'm not sure if we'll ever have one stat where you can rank a top 10, and that's going to be your clear-cut top 10. I don't know if war is meant to be that, but I definitely don't think war is that. And I think you can find all kinds of examples. Jeff Bagwell is one where you look at his war, in terms of career WAR, and it's pretty far up there. And I don't want to take away from the career that Jeff Bagwell had, but you compare it to a guy like Joe DiMaggio, for example, and Jeff Bagwell has a higher WAR. And some people may think that Jeff Bagwell was a better player than Joe DiMaggio. I know there's a lot of people that probably don't think Jeff Bagwell had a better career than Joe DiMaggio despite a higher WAR. So that's one small example. But what I like about what Jeff Zimmerman has done is he was looking at how defense is added to the equation in terms of WAR. And this is what I like about this, because WAR is a formula just like everything else. And when we get more information, I think it's important to revisit concepts like this and try to adjust concepts and try and make them better and even more useful. So that's what I like about the article that Jeff Zimmerman wrote. He named it Reexamining WAR's Defensive Spectrum. So basically looking at the defensive slice of WAR. And this is what I have struggled with, I think, most when it comes to WAR, is the defensive part. Now, we're going to get into the conversation here, and you're going to hear how it affects Edgar Martinez. I don't know if most people are aware, is if you're a DH, you take a pretty big penalty if you're the DH in terms of WAR, because you're not playing the field. So there's an automatic minus in terms of runs, and it's a pretty steep minus. So we'll get into that, how it affects Edgar Martinez. We'll talk a little bit about pitching WAR too, which I think is incredibly difficult to calculate when you're trying to isolate how a pitcher performs and put it into a WAR formula as you try and take out the defensive factors, the ballpark factors, everything else. When you're truly trying to isolate a pitcher's performance, I think it's a pretty interesting topic, and we'll talk more about this on another show. But here it is, without further ado, Jeff Zimmerman. What attracted you to kind of visit the defensive spectrum in terms of WAR?
Well, the one thing that I had noticed, and it had been an ongoing theme, was teams themselves seem to value first baseman and players on the lower defensive end of the spectrum, DHs, corner outfielders, more than what the general public was. And the general public was putting more value on shortstops, middle infielders, and catchers. And after talking with a few people, including Dave Cameron, we were kind of looking at, like, I think some numbers have changed from when it was originally done, and we needed to kind of look into it to see where the spectrum currently is. And I think that when it was initially done, there was very little data available, just a couple of years. And I think just some outliers during that time kind of put the numbers just more at the extremes. And when I looked at it, it kind of seemed like the players should be a little bit more valued a little bit closer than what they had been.
Yeah, because you go back to the beginning, and for people that don't know, there's values placed on positions. For example, catchers, shortstops get the most value. DHs get the least amount of value, right?
Right. Which I kind of argue that that's probably the same as first base. Like, it's hard to find a really good hitting shortstop. Mm-hmm. And there's the list is like three deep, maybe. Mm-hmm. Troy Tulowitzki, maybe I'm done. And then it's like a good hitting first baseman is a lot easier to find, or a corner outfielder. So it's like if a good hitting, shortstop like Tulowitzki, or even like a good hitting catcher like Buster Posey, he's so much better than the competition around him, he should get more value. Because if you want to go try to find any other catcher, it's really tough to really find someone that hits good. So they should get a little bit more value is what the original premise is, which a lot of people agree on, but it's how much value they're getting is kind of where I came on the disagreement with.
And the article you wrote is very detailed. It's fantastic on Hardball Times. What did you find? What was kind of the thumbnail of your conclusions?
That the main thing I found was that the spectrum that we had thought was actually a lot closer. That there's not as much difference or value should be given to a shortstop than a first baseman. And the other thing that was kind of interesting here recently, which I can see it flip over time, is one of the things is they found out right now, currently center fielders are hitting better than even left and right fielders. I think it's kind of just because of a glut of like McCutcheon and Trout, and it's just like we have some really good center fielders right now. And there was even a time, and that's where that they kind of ignored, which maybe should have been the case, where we had some really good hitting shortstops in the league, and Alex Rodriguez and Derek Jeter. But if you kind of look over the history of it, is what I was looking at, that right now, it's just the spectrum isn't as much. It seems like the hitters are a little bit closer together than they previously were in the past.
I think something that connects to we've been talking about quite a bit that's come up in the last few weeks. Of course, we talk about Edgar Martinez and the Hall of Fame. That conversation seems to come up all the time in Seattle, as you can probably imagine. And it's interesting how this connects to Edgar Martinez in terms of designated hitter and the penalty a guy like Edgar gets. How does that tie in?
Well, the one thing I found out and is – being the designated hitter is hard. It seems like the designated hitter, for some reason, compared to when they hit first base, and this is over all of time, hits worse as the designated hitter. It's just hard being in the game, probably sitting down. You probably have your muscles cold. The reasons aren't exact, and there's probably multiple reasons going into it. But what I found was is even removing for injuries, this was one thing I thought I might find, is that it wasn't harder. It was just like players like a lot of the New York Yankees DHs. It's just who's hurt, what, you're hurt, you're the DH. Mm-hmm. You know, Teixeira, Beltran. So you have these hurt players, and they're just worse. But what I found is it was still pretty hard. The hurt players are obviously performing a lot worse than when they were out in the field when they were DHing, but it was still really tough to DH. And it looks like they should be getting a little bit more value. They should almost be valued because it's so much harder to hit, and the players that can do it good should be getting a lot more value right now and should almost be valued the same as first baseman. And previously they were considered quite a bit, I don't know how exactly to say it, but they were probably like had about half the value as a first baseman. They were getting quite a bit of a penalty for being a DH.
And it's amazing when you consider where is Edgar at in baseball reference war. He's sitting with some pretty good players. I mean, Eddie Murray and Carlton Fisk, he's tied with them. And just behind Tony Gwynn, he's ahead of Sandberg. But if you make the adjustment that you suggest, I mean, he's ahead of Molitor and Bench and Reggie Jackson and Frank Thomas. In his case in particular, it's a significant difference.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the people that tout war as the measure can kind of get behind Martinez. He's, like I said, he was, if you look at some of the values that you're talking about, he's close but kind of iffy. But I think there's some other people that will say he just DH'd, therefore he's not getting it. Mm-hmm. Even though Frank Thomas did a lot of it, there's other players that do it the same way, that it's just like, I think it's going to be an issue that it was like, you were DH, we're just not going to put you in. And I think some of the players from Colorado are getting that. It's like, oh, you were in Colorado, so you're going to have good numbers. But the problem is, it was like, even if you kind of adjust to like the other parks, it was like, they were still good hitters, you know? So I think like they're almost getting too much of a penalty for being in certain situations.
Visiting with Jeff Zimmerman from Fangraphs, Hardball Times, BaseballHeatMaps.com, RotoWire as well. You can see him on Twitter, Jeff W. Zimmerman. How important do you think is it to revisit some of these concepts as we get more and more information?
I think it's actually kind of really important. I know when it was originally put out that the numbers, the person that originally, or a lot of people that did it, it's like, oh, these are nice round numbers, and they kind of adjusted them a little bit. And initially, I kind of had a problem with that. I was like, well, if this is what it is, let's put it at that and not really kind of, you know, quote-unquote, make it easy. Mm-hmm. It's like, let's make it what it's right. And that would have narrowed the spectrum a little bit. But I think the numbers will change. And one of the issues we're finding out is a lot of the numbers were originally done right at the peak of the PED era. Mm-hmm. And now we've come out of that era and kind of into a bigger strike zone, a lot of strikeout. So we're getting the hitters hitting less and the pitcher's getting a bigger strike zone. It's just like those numbers that were calculated or that we looked at back then just don't apply anymore, or don't apply as much, or they've changed because the game has changed a lot here. Kind of had two things kind of working against it, with the documented bigger strike zone and then the lack of PEDs, which is definitely, looking at some of the aging curves and stuff like that I've done, it's definitely a change from pre- and post-band era.
You also recently attacked pitcher war, which I tip my hat, because I think pitcher war is difficult. I think it's really difficult to pin down a pitcher war. Do you have an ideal formula at this point of what pitcher war should be in trying to determine a pitcher war?
No, and when I did that one, I had a little bit of new data. Mm-hmm. We had a little bit better fielding data than had been available to the general public. So I was like, let me take a stab at it. Because the big thing that hasn't been available for the general public is if pitchers have ability to generate weak contact, or if it's because they have a good defense behind them. You know, it's, are they able to control the contact that they get? And that's, a lot of times they can control the type of it. It's kind of like a ground ball pitcher or a fly ball pitcher. But a lot of it kind of depends on what their defense is behind them. You know, can they actually catch the pop-ups? I mean, I get to watch Kansas City all the time, which is nice to see. Now field defense, just pretty much anything in the air gets caught. But then there's other teams, it's kind of just a misadventure watching them out there. And I think it's really tough. I think there'll hopefully be some improvements. But everything I've looked at so far, it almost just comes back to, just to keep it simple, is just strike out as many players as you can and don't walk as many. That it's trying to look into that batted ball stuff. It's just people aren't able to find it, and neither have I. It's like, well, there's a couple pitchers and maybe, but trying to look back and trying to determine who those are before the fact is just doesn't seem to be able to. We're not able to seem to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's so difficult, and you're in Kansas City, so you get to see a guy like Chris Young who defies so much logic in terms of a lot of this stuff, in terms of the contact he produces. We get to watch Felix Hernandez every 5 days, and you know his heavy changeup and the amount of ground balls he can produce. It's so difficult to me in splicing out all the factors to come up with a true number.
Right, and that's a lot of times I just push with like pitchers is the strikeouts and walks, and then if they can keep those within a reasonable number, then you can start kind of diving into like the ground ball numbers and so forth. But I mean, if you can't do, if you just end up walking too many people or can't strike anyone out, I mean, we're dealing with Jeremy Guthrie right now. Which,
there you go.
I mean, it's like one person said, the only park that the ball can stay in with him right now is Yellowstone. So it's rough, like I said, watching him. But it's like once it leaves the yard, once he just gets hit a little too much and he just can't strike anyone out. So every ball's in play, and he still kind of walks some guys. So it's an adventure every day when he pitches.
Do you ever see a scenario where we come up with the perfect number? Is it always going to be kind of a you take as much data as you possibly can to come up with your conclusion instead of just one base number?
I think they'll start getting closer and people will start, I wouldn't say start believing it more, but I think it's going to be tough between like a predictive one and like what they've actually done. And I think that's kind of a problem right now, especially like a lot of people have a problem with the defensive numbers, and they'll see someone every day make great, great plays. And we noticed that, I kind of noticed it one time with like a 3-game stretch with Escobar, our shortstop there here at Kansas City, and he was just like making play after play. But the problem was, is there were making outs. It was like he'd go in the hole, make a deep throw, and you know, the runner would just beat it. Mm-hmm. Well, the deal is like I look at him and I see him as a great defensive player, but the numbers aren't indicating that he's making the out. I think that happens also with hitters, where it's like that guy just hit a screaming line drive, it went over the wall, and then Mike Trout, you know, jumps up, makes this amazing catch. Well, 99% of the time that was going to be a home run, and we know this guy can hit. He can hit the, you know, line drive home runs, but the numbers don't say he got the home run. So I think a lot of times with the defensive numbers, people have problems believing them because, and I think that's what's going to be the worst thing, is they may see the player as a much better player than what his numbers put out. But I think people have gotten to the point where they believe the offensive numbers. Like, these are his exact home runs. He's hit 8 home runs, but I don't know, who knows? He could have had 2 or 3 of them stolen throughout the year. Maybe not that number, but, you know, you can still be unlucky and hit the ball really good.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Lastly, I have to ask you about this, since you're in Kansas City, and, of course, the playoff run last year, everything going great this year for KC. What has it been like the past, I don't know, season and a half, I guess, watching this Kansas City Royals team?
It has been fun. We just have not had any postseason for so long that, I mean, in my lifetime, I'm trying to think, I was 10, which I actually understood 85, but it was just like, even just going to the playoffs, I think most people I knew just like, I'm not missing a playoff game. And I was the same way. Like, I had tickets bought to the wild card and, you know, the first round, and I didn't even know which one we were because toward the end of the season, it was still up for grabs. But it's definitely nice seeing people, and it's behind the team, a lot more Royals gear being worn. It was definitely kind of turning into football country, and I think people will support the team even if they don't make it now a lot better. I mean, it's really rough right now watching the starting staff. I mean, we're still getting some good offense. The defense is great. The bullpen's great. It's, the offense is okay. But like I said, it's been fun. It's definitely been fun, and it's nice being able to watch competitive baseball into the summer. I mean, a lot of times we were done at the end of May. It was just effectively the season was over. I mean, there was one year I think we were like 20 games under 500 or something by then. So it's just like, well, you know, on to next year or hope for even 2 or 3 years from now. But I think as long as we can stay around 500 or above, things will be good. I mean, kind of had a rough stretch right now, and we'll see how things turn out.
Well, Jeff, this is it was great to visit with you. These are can be some tricky concepts, but I really like the way you approached them. And again, I recommend Hardball Times to read Jeff's stuff on WAR. You can see him on Twitter, Jeff W. Zimmerman. I'm Fangraphs as well, baseballheatmaps.com. Jeff, thanks for the time. We appreciate it. Hopefully we'll do it again down the road.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I thought that was excellent. If you have any questions, he was great. I thought he tried to keep it really simple. And if you go to his article, hardballtimes.com, it is very in-depth and it's pretty thick. So if you want more, that's a great place to go. You can always tweet me or email me as well if you have any questions or follow-up or anything like that. And I think it's pretty interesting, especially the stuff about Edgar Martinez as well. And we'll continue this sort of conversation as we move through the year. I think it's a good one. Right now, though, we're going to talk some changeup. Renis Elias on the mound with his changeup.
Seattle has a long history with the changeup, going back to Jamie Moyer, who befuddled and frustrated hitters with his Bugs Bunny-style change.
Imagine that, the old Jamie Moyer changeup. You going to swing at it?
I don't know. Looks a little high.
Here's the 1-2 pitch. Strike 3 called. Got him looking with a pitch on the outside corner. That'll retire the side. Moyer striking out. Barry Bonds looking.
Oh, man. You got to swing at that.
Told you.
Jamie used that change. In 11 years with the Mariners, won 145 games, tossing over 2,000 innings in a Mariners uniform.
Jamie into his wind in the 2-2 to Barry. Swing and a miss. He struck him out. Pitch right in on his hand.
It was slow, for sure. The thing that set his changeup apart was the location of it, number one, his consistency in where he was able to locate it. That being said, he was able to locate it on the outside corner of the plate, but then he was able to sort of, you know, take that extra ball's width and throw it there, and then even another ball's width outside of that, and was able to sort of climb the ladder away, if you will, with that changeup and get guys to continue to chase it out there. And I think that's what really made him so deadly.
That was his catcher, Dan Wilson. And of course, the king, Felix Hernandez, known for his devastating changeup. At least Torrey Hunter thinks we call it a changeup.
His splitty was unbelievable, changeup. It was unbelievable. It went down and in, and then it kind of cut away, and he had 2 different splitties, and change-ups, and I was shocked.
The 2-2, swing and a miss, strike 3, a change-up, a venomous change-up at 90 miles an hour. Upton
hacks right through that pitch from the King, who was fan seven.
Last 12 to 14 inches before it gets to the plate, it's literally like someone steps on the ball, you know, and it goes straight down. And Ben guys swing and miss it or hit. He gets incredible amount of ground balls on the pitch. And it looks just like his fastball because he's able to maintain that great arm speed.
There's fellow Cy Young Award winner R.A. Dickey paying tribute to his change.
And the 1-1. Swing and a ground ball to Brad Miller at short. He's got it. The throw to first in time to get Smolinski. And Felix Hernandez is the all-time leader in Mariner history for innings pitched. Now with 2,093 and a third innings as he moves by Jamie Moyer.
And it's been more of the same this year. Hitters batting just 151 with 13 singles and one triple off of his changeup. But now there's one pitcher on the staff who rivals those numbers with his changeup.
The 2-2, swing and a miss. Oh, what a beauty there from Elias.
This year, Roenis Elias batters just batting 114 against his change.
Pitch to Springer, swing and a miss, strike three. Manny took a big hack at that pitch, up and away.
Roenis Elias talks about the difference between last year and this year with his changeup.
Very important at this time. Last year, he had a lot of problems with his changeup. This year, he worked on it, and everything's coming out good. He threw his changeup too hard last year, and this year he's throwing it. Let the grip work.
And pitching coach Rick Waits agrees.
Yeah, I think he's trying not to overthrow. You know, he's a very passionate, emotional type of pitcher. And so I love that in a pitcher because, therefore, you're in the game. You go with the flow of the game. And so I think he's controlling the emotions better. He's really focusing from pitch to pitch. One thing we've really been working on, not only his bullpens, but in his throwing program, that every pitch counts. And don't take a vacation on any pitch. And he's really taken to that. And, you know, staying consistent, staying focused, and it's paying off.
It's been a go-to weapon for Elias. In his last two starts, he's thrown it 67 times combined. So we'll watch closely today. How many times will we see that change from Roenis Elias?
See you later!